AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vassilash, episode 367 for March 3rd of 2017. Cadillac sags, Lexus sinks, and diesels are about to die. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Mr. V, good to see you here.
Good to be seen. And as I seem to talk about the weather every time the show begins, I was in Austin, Texas this week, which was like summer. And I came back, and it seems like winter has returned to Detroit.
Well, if you had come back the middle of yesterday afternoon, it would have been a balmy 65 degrees, and it got real windy and started snowing last night. So that's how crazy the weather is here.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, we got to let everybody know who's joining us in the studio today. We have got Alisa Priddle from Motor Trend Magazine. Alisa, it's always great to have you here.
It's excellent to be here.
Excellent. I like that. I don't know if anyone's told us it's excellent, but someone's got to be the first. And we've got Stephanie Brinley from IHS Market.
Yep.
Automotive. Or did you drop
just
the automotive?
Drop the automotive.
IHS
Market now. Yep. And thanks for having me again. It's great to join you guys again.
Cool. Well, we got plenty to talk about. And Gary, why don't you get us started?
All right. So sales, right? So You shook your head.
Well, no, I mean
you shook your head like no.
No, yesterday was March 1st, so yeah. That
okay,
means
I thought you were like you were gonna say, man, this is bad news. I mean, it wasn't that bad.
The no,
SAAR was down 1.1%, which was pretty good.
Volume was down. Yeah.
And I mean, I just was looking at some interesting things. I mean, just some little categories, and I want you guys to respond to them. Okay, so Cadillac for the month. Okay, so February 2017 versus February 2016 was down 8.6%. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then I look at our friends at Lincoln, and for February 2017, February 2016, up 8.8%. So, you know, some of us were thinking not that long ago that perhaps Lincoln didn't have a future. So, Looking at this dynamic that's going on there, what do you think? Cadillac versus Lincoln.
But you know why? You're looking at it the wrong way. You're looking at luxury maker versus luxury maker. You should be looking at cars versus
trucks,
trucks or crossovers. Because the story with Lincoln is all
MKC, MKX, and Navigator.
It's not by coincidence that there's reports that they're going to get rid of the MKZ.
But
realize there's a Cadillac.
Cadillac's got a lot of trucks.
They don't have the third SUV right now, MKC. They don't. Lincoln has the MKC. Cadillac doesn't have the third SUV right now. And if you look to it, Cadillac's incentives were down for the month as well. So that and Lincoln's incentives were up slightly, and they've been high compared to the industry. Mm-hmm. So Lincoln's incentives is a little bit healthier right now than Cadillac was pulling back on incentives. That had some effect on it, and part of it is product.
And Cadillac just has more of a mix of cars and crossovers, right. Whereas Lincoln has gotten very crossover heavy and are going to be even more crossover heavy because that's the direction that they're headed.
Right.
And to her point about incentives, the one thing that I have to say about Cadillac that I've admired about Johann is that he said right out of the gate that he was not going to buy share and that he was going to hold off incentives, and that's the only way he was going to get that brand to where he wanted it to be value-wise. And right after he said it, small cars immediately took a plummet.
Right.
And he just let it happen. And I have to say that his discipline in letting that happen, because I thought at some point the board or someone would step in and say, we're not going to put up with this. But they seem to be letting him have his way in bringing the brand to where it needs to be. Now, it could be that he's being heard on. We're hearing about a lot of future products that are not going to continue. You know, they're not going to come either at all or in the time frame we thought. So maybe that's where they're taking the money out of it. But I do give him props for holding the line on incentives.
I agree with that completely. I also think that it's that 2017 is going to be. In 2016, we were watching incentives and seeing where things were. But in 2017, we're looking at a slight contraction. So all of that discipline and sales and full year sales, our forecast is for about 17.4 million, which is slightly below. It's still a really healthy market, but it means year on year sales are going to be more difficult to accomplish. And that means that the discipline that they were able to show in 15 and 16, it's going to be even harder this year across the board for the industry. And that's still there's still time to slip that up. I do think Cadillac has been very strong on that that space, though, in keeping their incentives down and being willing to let it ride for a little bit. And this year also, from seeing some things, I think they're going to bump up some of the advertising, even though they're advertising traditional models and not necessarily new cars, which usually they throw their marketing money behind the brand new cars. They don't have a brand new one right now. So they're looking at more advertising this year, which could help, actually.
Okay, but I'm sitting in the Rensen, and I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, Cadillac is down 6.5% for the first 2 months of the year, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, these guys at Cadillac are up 15.2%.
No, Lincoln.
Sorry. So how do I feel about that?
Well, I don't feel good if I'm at Cadillac, and especially as we've been talking about on this show, the Lincoln Continental right out of the box is outselling the Cadillac CT6. No problem whatsoever. I think sales were 50% higher in the last month for the Continental. Mm-hmm. And the guys at Cadillac must be knocking their brains out, because I would argue dynamically, technology, mixed material, blah, 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 that the CT6 is a superior car.
Mm-hmm. But it's very much a matter of taste. They couldn't be at further ends of the spectrum.
Exactly.
So if you want the high-tech, edgy, then you're going to go for Cadillac. Continental really appeals. It's the mac and cheese, you know. It's a comfort food. It's comfy. It's sort of got an elegance. You feel like you're being pampered in it. And
but isn't that why I like the car?
No, not necessarily.
Let's talk about names. Continental's a great name. CT6 is not.
Yeah, I mean, so CT6, right?
There are a lot of people excited to see the Continental name come back.
But do you think, honestly, visually, if you look at a CT6 and you look at a Continental, I mean, it's not like looking at a CTS in a Continental. I mean, I think that the CT6 is more rounded and more Continental-like. I mean, it's not all that. I mean, certainly, we just saw a picture of the front fascia with the Cadillac signature lights. I think they're doing a great job with those lights. But you get away from the front, look at the side view, look at the rear view, and it's just like,
They do feel fundamentally different to drive. And I think, too, when you look at Cadillac and both the Lincoln and the Cadillac have tons of technology, and the Lincoln is much more comfortable and it's much more plush. If you look for a car that's really fun to drive dynamically and has the technology and it's cutting edge in that way, Cadillac has more competition in that space than Lincoln does. Lincoln has brought back a formula and done it really well that people have, that automakers
no one else is doing.
They're not doing right now. Lexus is even
G90.
Well, Genesis is closer to that. No, I
Genesis
would agree with
is closer to that, but that's not their target. Their target is to be a little bit more dynamic. Their target is not to be that comfortable. Lexus is the only one that had been targeting that comfort, and Lexus is trying to get away from that a little bit and get more passionate, a little bit more
there's
exciting.
Another good comparison. As long as we're comparing Cadillac and Lincoln, compare Lexus and Infiniti. Because also polar opposites in terms of what happened last month in the marketplace.
Lexus has headed really, and Infiniti's got some fresher product right now, but still,
Lexus's
slip has been
down like 20%.
Lexus down 20.6%.
And I want to say
Infiniti was up 32.5%. Okay,
but let's huge difference. In fact, I want to say Infiniti outsold Cadillac.
Infiniti 13737.
Easily outsold Cadillac.
But again, it's kind of like Toyota.
Cadillac,
I mean, it's very car heavy. I mean, Toyota was down about 10% again because they're very car heavy. Anyone who was car heavy
was impacted.
Is really seeing their numbers.
I don't think even Lexus's trucks did all that well.
Everything was Acura struggled a lot too. I don't think there was anything on Acura's side that was year over year up.
Yeah, I mean, beyond the RX, you don't really think of trucks and Lexus.
True.
Lexus truck.
I mean, I mean, RX is a big volume vehicle. I'm not putting that down. But you sort of feel like it's a one-trick pony on the truck side.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing that I thought was interesting, so I was looking, I mean, the hot area now is the compact crossover, mm-hmm. right? So Equinox, even though there's going to be a new Equinox in February, did exceedingly well, 22,464. Escape, completely on fire, 27,637, up 15.9%. RAV4, 26,351, up 3.2%.
Now, drum roll, I know where you're going. There's one more.
Well, there's one that he's okay. not going to bring up, but the Volvo XC60, which is in its final gasp, has had its best
Volvo
year ever.
The Volvo XC60?
Yes.
No one's going to buy an Equinox or a Volvo.
But to your point, the segment is so hot that it's about to be replaced, and it just had its best.
Oh, okay.
That's insane.
CRV, 31,896.
But I think Nissan Rogue beat it.
Did it?
I think
Rogue was on fire.
Nissan Rogue was the best-selling non-pickup truck.
I want to double-check the incentives on that. it's still a hangover from the movie advertising that really did
seem to
resonate.
No, you know why it did so well?
Uh-huh.
We had Fred Diaz on the show.
Oh, well, that's right.
That must be it. Yeah.
That was it. He's in charge of trucks
and
for Rogue
Nissan. When they add the Rogue Sport, they're going to be adding the sales together. Then those numbers are really going to be big. Because they're going to count it as one sales line.
One nameplate.
They're different vehicles.
Qashqai,
it's the Qashqai.
Right?
And it will still be sold as the Qashqai in Canada.
Oh, I didn't know you guys had the Qashqai in Canada.
No, it's going to, when it comes, it's going to be called the Qashqai in Canada and the Rogue Sport in the U.S. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. And the explanation was that, because Canadians are so European, we're like, yeah, but we're really close to the border of the U.S.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, the Qashqai is the name of the vehicle that's number one seller for Nissan in Europe.
Right, and I dare the people on the show to spell Qashqai without Googling it. It has two Qs.
I dare the people at Nissan to sell Qashqai.
Right. It has two Qs and no Us. Okay, I'll just give you a hint right off the top. Mm-hmm. And there's no evidence that Canadians are better spellers than Americans, so I don't know why it's going to be called Qashqai in Canada. But there's my little rant for that. Uh-huh.
But you know, one of the things that sort of struck me is when I was looking at these crossovers. You know, so the model of the architecture came from what company? Jeep, right? Mm. And Jeep sales were down in February. And now we were talking about, last week we were talking about the new Compass. And, you know, I'm thinking, is that going to be competitive with the Escape and the RAV4 and the CRV?
Yeah, but part of the issue is that the numbers are skewed by them having wrong numbers last year. So you kind of have FCA.
Yeah, but they should have reported the corrected number when they did the year-over-year.
But if we're looking at Jeep brand, I mean, basically, you know, Wrangler is up 2%, and this is from them, not from anybody else. Grand Cherokee is up 11%, Renegade is up 11%, right? So basically what we have is the quintessential Jeep Wrangler up 2%, and then you have the tiny one up 11%, and then the big one up 11% as well. But I'm just thinking in the mid market, right, where the Escape is, mm-hmm. for example,
where Compass should be,
is that where it's going to be?
Yes,
it
will.
But it does have and introducing the new one. So I wonder. I don't know.
I interviewed Mike Manley last week.
Yeah. What did he say about the sell down?
So he said, look, here, because I brought this up. I said your sales have been dropping for 3 months in a row, and that's before we got these numbers. And he said, hold on. Yeah. Compass and Patriot are going out. So, I mean, those sales have absolutely cratered. He said, we're just blowing them out the door, making room for the new one. And I said, okay, what about Cherokee? And he goes, we're taking down our fleet sales big time. He says, in fact, for the first half of this year in the U.S. market, he says, we're going to look bad. Mm-hmm. He says, I just come out and tell you that. We're not going to look good. It's going to be so hard for us to look good in the first half, partly because first half last year was so hot.
Yep.
And I said, well, how many fleet sales do you guys have? And he says, we're not releasing that number.
Because it's so big.
I talked to some of their other people who were a little bit looser, close to 25%. of all Cherokee sales went to fleet. So they're taking that down. Compass and Patriot sales are down big time right now. The real question is, can the new Compass make up for both Patriot and Compass sales of old?
No.
You don't think so?
We
Why
don't
not?
Think so. We don't think that the new one is getting a little bit more expensive. It's getting a little bit bigger. And you just don't grow that way. When you take a model away, you inevitably lose some sales. It's very difficult. They're not going to be able to do it with the Pacifica either. With the Pacifica and the Caravan, they're not going to be able, even though it's two different brands, but they're not going to be able to do that either. And our projections right now are not, they won't be able to do that. However, the new Compass is being built in four different plants across the world, and it's expanding into a lot more markets. So the overall global Compass sales
will look phenomenal.
Will look great. They will be above what Jeep, what Patriot and Compass sales were before. But for the U.S. market, we don't expect that the Compass model will be able to quite deliver exactly. It should be strong. We are looking at some healthy numbers, but we aren't looking at it meeting the combination.
Oh, very interesting.
So this sort of leads to a question. I mean, the importance of other markets. I mean, Stephanie, as you just said, that, you know, you have the Compass and you know, four plants, none of which is in the U.S.
No.
And you know, we were talking earlier about Cadillac, and I was looking that Cadillac announced this afternoon that in China they sold 27,000 units January and February. Mm-hmm. In the United States, they sold 21,000 units. So now
Cadillac's even bigger in China.
Bigger
wow.
In China. So
everything's bigger in China.
Yeah, yeah, but I didn't know the crossover point had happened.
So, yeah. So the question is, I mean, does this market begin to become less important to companies in general? I mean, just that. I mean, and not even from the point of view of looking at it like
no.
Just
from, no, she says yes. I say no, and I also say it's time for a quick break. So we'll come back and pick up this argument in just a matter of seconds, because right now we're going to give a shout out to our good friends who keep this show going, Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. And what were we going to argue
about?
All right,
so the importance of China versus the United States.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Right.
I do think that yes, it will change the way that automakers fundamentally view the U.S. However, U.S. is still number two. So it doesn't mean that the U.S. no longer matters, but it will change the dynamic between the two and between the way that some products are developed. The other half of that is that both markets are large enough that they need their own manufacturing plants. They need their own infrastructure to support each market. So there's still the ability to have a car that is tailored to the U.S. or tailored to China. So
I agree with you. Tailoring cars to markets is critically important. Here's why I think China, from a business standpoint, is not as important. General Motors sold almost 4 million vehicles in China last year, 3.8 plus blah, blah, blah. It made a profit of $500 million. Okay, think about that. Almost 4 million vehicles, $500 million in profit. In the United States, General Motors sold 3 million vehicles and made $12 billion in profit. So let that roll around a bit.
Right. Well, and again,
China,
David, the mix is different, right? Okay, so pickups are not being sold in China. Small vehicles are.
Well, they're just starting with pickups. We'll see where that goes. But you're right.
So that is a big part of it.
Right.
The other reason that the U.S. is important is the reason that people in China want Cadillacs is because they're popular in the U.S. If they were not popular here, I argue that they would not be doing as well over there, because they do want the best of the West. But having the profits from China and having the volume and the sharing the common parts and the cost savings and all of that, that is what lets something like Buick survive, you know, because they're not going to sell enough here. I mean, that is, you know, they really need each other.
They really do.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not saying that you can't get away from it. But all I'm saying is that if I'm running a business, I'm going to put most of my investment where I can make the biggest profit. And right now, the U.S. by far is a much richer market than China is.
Well, if you're playing in China, you're playing with a JV and you're sharing.
Well, you got to give half your profits your joint venture partner.
It's a little.
That's right.
The function is different, but and it's China's only going to get bigger.
It's only going to get bigger
and wealthier.
But and wealthier, I grant you that. But China's also choking on traffic. I'm not sure how much bigger it's going to get. Because you just can't accommodate that many vehicles as
There's development in three, four, and five tier cities. It's tier one
that's
and two.
Too. So what you're saying right now is sprawl. Is the third tier cities that don't have really terrible traffic in a few
years will be choking on it.
And that's where, you know, this whole move to mobility services has got a lot of people wondering if, you know, if we're reaching peak car. Not right now, but in another decade.
In another decade, maybe. And the other element with with China and the vehicles as well too. You totally threw me off track with the mobility.
Oh, all right. So where was I going? So does China change? Like, forget the sales. All right. Let's put those aside for a second. Does China change the way vehicles look or the way that vehicles are contented? Are they going to change vehicles for the U.S. market? Okay, so that, you know, it becomes dominant.
Yeah,
that
a little bit.
If they like red, suddenly we're going to see a lot of red cars, right?
Yeah. I think things like a big back seat in a full-size sedan. They're not, gone are the days where you develop one for here and then you stretch it for there. You now develop it with China in mind from the outset.
Right.
Which is what we heard about the Continental when we had the Continental in the studio a few weeks ago.
We did.
But it was one model forever.
I got to tell you, it irks me. When car companies say, oh, we have to make more legroom in the rear because our Chinese customers want that. Oh, really? Your American customers don't? No, you made it small to cut weight. I mean, you had their knees up against the backs of the seats to meet your cafe target. So it kind of irks me when they say, well, we did it for the Chinese customer. I'm telling you, customers anywhere in the world like a lot of legroom.
Sort of. I mean, if you look at where long wheelbase versions sort of started, long wheelbase versions in Europe don't do as well as they do in the States or in China. And I do remember looking at the ATS-L when I was at the China show. I'm looking at this and going, why? Why is that just not the ATS everywhere? Because it did address the criticisms that car gets for the backseat issue. I know where I was going with China.
All right.
The other thing happening with China is you do still have indigenous manufacturers. Over time, they're going to get stronger. So the other thing that the foreign manufacturers have to do is make sure that they're protected for being part of that business going forward, and in some respects, maybe getting when you can. Because if China shifts a little bit and their buyers start to take their own brands more than they take the foreign brands, then, you know, is Buick going to be as successful as it is in China forever? Maybe, maybe not. So be profitable, make your money where you can now. Protect yourself for being able to be there in the future, understanding it may still yet, I mean, it'll change. We know it'll change. We just don't know exactly how.
Mm-hmm. So before we move from sales, I think we got to give a shout out to Volkswagen. Volkswagen, its sales were up. I mean,
two months in a row now.
They're doing up for the year. So good for them, right?
The comparison is
to a year ago when the scandal was at its height.
Right.
So, but, you know, you do need that caveat. But yes, they are bouncing back. People are buying their vehicles. And I don't think people already have the money in hand to...
Some do.
Yeah. But I don't think the numbers are huge.
You mean
huge
for the buybacks?
This is the diesel scandal.
I've talked to a lot of Volkswagen owners who have said they're going to take that money and buy another Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. So they're a very loyal group.
Are they going to buy Volkswagen diesel?
They can't. They're not going to offer them here.
There you go.
So which leads to
FCA telling its shareholders that there's a bit of a diesel problem with the 3-liter diesel engines in the Grand Cherokee and used in the race.
Well, you know, that's a shareholder statement that you have to make. I mean, the fact is there are lawsuits, there are investigations that are happening. Whether or not they are in or out of compliance, I don't know. But they are being investigated, and the government is looking at these harder and harder and harder right now and the fallout of the VW situation. And you have to disclose those things to your shareholders. You can't not bring that up. So I think that was really much more of a regulatory statement they had to make than admitting or saying that they know what's going to happen. They can't.
But they're being investigated,
right?
We already knew that. We already knew the investigation.
Right. And again, a lot of it is the backdrop. I mean, it is that they're ultra sensitive about diesels, the regulatory people. And even though FCA doesn't seem to, I mean, it doesn't look like they put a cheat device on. They just did things you're allowed to do but didn't disclose it, as Stephanie said. So very different. But what works against FCA is that FCA is not exactly in their in NHTSA's favor right now anyway. And part of their disclosing is there could be fines. They've already had all kinds of record fines for they're already in hot water because they have not disclosed things in a timely manner on recalls in the past. So they're already in the doghouse. And so they're going to be less likely to believe them when they're here's a, yet another example of you say you're doing things right. Well, you don't disclose things. You don't do things on time. You're not following the rules. So they might not be cheating, but You're not getting your homework in on time.
Yeah, you're right. They didn't get their homework in on time, and they were penalized from NHTSA. But I think there's a whole another level when you don't disclose what you're supposed to disclose to the SEC. NHTSA can fine them, but SEC has some power, too. And Wall Street
well, the other thing is Department of Justice is involved.
Yeah.
Look, not related to this case, but the EPA people have told me in the past, when we put out, I can't remember what they call it, an issue of notification or that was
notice of violation.
Notice of violation. They think they got it. This isn't just, oh, we think, no.
No,
it's not official. They're going for the throat, they told me. So this is just the next step. I think FCA is in deep trouble on this. You know, it's not quite the same as Volkswagen deliberately misleading, deliberately deceiving, but they're in trouble on this one.
So what does this do to the market for diesel engines in the United States for anything besides Class 8 trucks?
I think a little bit is a little bit of wait and see. See how it shakes out. VW seems to be recovering, at least in terms of consumers coming back to the showroom.
Right, but they're not buying diesel cars, right? Because you guys just said you can't, right?
Can't. Yeah.
So what does this do for? So there's going to be a diesel in the F-150, isn't that coming?
Yep,
and,
that's coming. Yep.
And there's the new diesel Cruise,
right? Mm-hmm. Going in the Equinox as well.
In Equinox, and so if you're a consumer, what does the consumer say?
We have to wait and see because the issue is whether or not they met emissions and that's something that consumers only kind of care about. They want it to be good, but they're not. It's not that direct to their lives. And the other thing is, with more diesels out there, we'll see what they react to it. Those diesels may be able to soak up some of the loss that for people that wanted diesels in the first place. But the diesel market was slipping in 2014 into 2015 prior to this issue. Yeah. The diesel market wasn't growing.
And it was giving way just to gasoline engines?
Gasoline
yes. and to EVs. And I know, you know, at the latest roundtable with Sergio Marchionne of FCA, and, you know, he was asked about the future of diesels, and he, you know, much like he says, small cars are going away. Diesels are going away, too, he thinks, including in Europe. I mean, that they're just a stopgap. He figures that the day is coming, and it's probably coming quicker than anyone thinks, that they will not be able to meet emission standards, and it will be far too expensive to make them do it, and people will just stop doing diesel. So it's already pulling back in the U.S. I think that you only are going to see them in trucks, really, in the U.S.
Yeah.
I don't understand why what GM is thinking with the Cruise, and I don't think there's enough people who want to jump on board with diesels right now. I still see it making sense for light trucks until we can't meet regulations, and then they're gone. And by then, your trucks are going to be hybrids, EVs, I mean, everything is going to go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And diesel is just something that will have served its course. I mean, it was fantastic for Europe where gas prices were high, but it's a technology that is on the wane, and I don't think it ever comes back.
And the European success was built on taxes. It was built on what was required there. It wasn't even necessarily built on what consumers wanted. They bought with what made more sense financially in that regard, and it was so different, the price between gasoline and tax.
Okay, but I remember
cities aren't going to allow them, and it's already many European cities are not allowing them in their city centers. So I mean that's another nail in the coffin.
Okay, yeah, but when we had Henry Payne, the auto critic for the Detroit News, on the show when the VW diesel scandal broke, and Henry pointed out quite strongly about how much fun it is to drive a diesel car. Right?
None of us dispute that.
Okay, so it's not like this is really, you know, bad technology. I mean, it's a gas, right? I mean, so people still like that.
And another thing that can happen if depending on how the FCA situation goes and depending on who else gets wrapped up into whether or not they disclose a certain piece of software or not, consumers are learning that diesel emissions are really difficult to make. And you might just realize that it's not possible to meet the emissions that, as we have set, and that can hurt, especially for a powertrain choice that is not hugely popular. It was lower than manual transmissions, as I recall.
Wow.
Yeah. We all love them, but not everyone has driven one.
Right.
And again, and it's the business case that's going away. It's not the love of driving it. That's going to be completely irrelevant in the equation.
Plus, diesel fuel is really stinky.
Not anymore. It is not.
No, the fuel, when you go pump it.
But you don't smell it in the vehicles anymore.
No, you don't smell it in the vehicles. You got to pump it. It's horrible.
Okay, now we're going to take a break in this conversation. We're not going to take a break, but, we've gone to the point in the show, and we'll get back to the rest of the discussion. We're getting a lot of questions from the audience, too, and we'll get into that. But it is time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so this one, I want you guys not only to tell me what these numbers represent, but then I'm going to ask you why these numbers are what these numbers are. So, Carmen, please bring it up. So this is it, okay? San Juan, Puerto Rico, down 16.9%. Austin, Texas, down 11.9%. Washington, D.C., 10.2%. Miami, Florida, down 9.5%. And San Jose, California, down 8.8%. What could be down these rather significant numbers? And I just picked the top five, and there are a whole bunch of cities that are on this list.
Vehicle registrations?
Mm-mm.
That's not cars. That's too easy.
Now, the source says city.
City Lab. This is a publication.
City Lab. So it's got something to do with cities.
Yeah, well, so these are all cities.
And this looks like the blurry background. I'm looking at it, and I can't tell. It looks like a gas station.
No.
No? Okay. Then I'm going to take a wild guess.
Commuters?
What?
Bus riders, commuters, public transportation numbers?
She got it. Yes. So in all of these cities, so there's
fewer people are riding the bus
that are using mass transit right across the board. Even New York City, they're like the MTA is like, what the hell's going on here?
Do I get a prize?
Oh,
you do. You should get a prize.
I do.
Yeah, we'll give you one of the baseball hats that we got sitting in a pile that all the car companies have given us.
Yeah.
Or a pen.
You've never gotten one of those.
No, I don't know. Maybe a report.
But what's the deal? So here we have. I mean, there are more people who are
Ubering.
Is that Ubering? Do you think it's Ubering?
Yeah, I think it's Lyft and Uber and
ride sharing of every sort.
Ride sharing and car sharing,
well,
I think,
things.
Is having a little less traction than Uber and Lyft, which is, if you strip away the fact that it's a fancy app, it's just a cheaper taxi. I think those are the two things that are impacting it more than
But I wonder, okay, so I mean, the thing that I wonder about is municipalities seem to want to be able to have improve mass transit. I mean, so in Detroit, we've just opened the Q line that goes down Woodward, right? You drive all the time, so you probably
haven't hopped on it yet.
But I mean, so is it going to be the situation where municipalities are going to have to say, well, maybe we got to rethink our entire mass transit approach because of things like Lyft and Uber? And
I don't think we're there yet. I think where we are there is in Detroit, for example, because we're just starting to try and put in a mass transit line that was only medium thought out to begin with. That might make it more difficult to do that here. But if you've got more established places, I mean, the San Juan number being down 16% is pretty huge. And part of what's driving that is not just the mass transit is more expensive or less popular, but you're putting up another alternative that's cooler and hipper right now. So, you're way cooler if you just take an Uber or if you just
The person who
different.
Doesn't own a car now, before his only choice was to get a regular, good old-fashioned cab. And now he's got all these other alternatives that are easy and inexpensive. You don't even have to, if you want to go even cheaper than the Uber, the shared ones.
Right.
Yeah.
But I've got to believe taking a bus is cheaper.
It is.
Right? And
it is, but it's not cool.
Taking a subway, I mean.
But you could be waiting a half an hour for the bus.
I mean, if you're just going to the doctor or something, it's just like, you're not going to be cool. You're going to the doctor.
Right, but you're waiting a half an hour at the bus stop, whereas your Uber shows up in 2 minutes.
All right, so what about cities like New York where there's a subway?
They are going to have to.
People still take those.
You're going to have to evaluate.
But it's decreasing as well.
But what it does is it means they have to figure out how to entice buyers. So instead of just sort of being there and playing it out and saying, all right, we're here, you'll use us because we're here, you've got to figure out how to entice it and how to make people more interested in doing that. And you have to accept that that you may see some shifts and changes anyway.
One other thing, too, to think about is during recessions, public transit gets used more.
Mm-hmm.
In full employment, people go, I'm not riding the bus. I'm getting the car. I'll pay for Uber. I'll get a taxi or whatever. Yeah, so I think that's probably playing into this as well.
And the other thing is public mass transportation doesn't necessarily ever really make money. It's not that sort of thing. So you have to expect that you're going to have some booms and losses. And it's not fundamentally about being profitable. It's about serving the people. So the question is, how much money can you lose and for how long? Before
and
it's a real problem.
And congestion means that it's going to become more important. Yeah. I mean, I think to John's point, we are in kind of nice, heady times now. People can afford to do these things.
It's terrible. But just terrible. It's a mess.
It's awful.
It's a mess.
That's right. It all depends on who you ask.
That's fake news, Gary.
But
I have not talked to the Russians. I just want to make that clear.
No, congestion does change the equation in the cities that...
And we are expecting more congestion and adding more...
Yeah, because all these people are no longer riding mass transit.
Well, you know, I think there... Watch what happens there because, look, there's no question that city managers are having this very conversation. Why should we put hundreds of millions of dollars into a new bus fleet that we're going to have for 20 years, much less what they spend on that new subway station in New York? A couple of billion dollars. So should we really be making these investments if in the next decade all this ride-sharing, car-sharing, mobility services,
autonomy
is going to throw everything up in the air.
Exactly.
Hey, as I said before, we've got a number of questions, some of which we've already been talking about, but Jonathan Wills tweeted in to say, can you explain Nissan Rogue sales? You were touching on it a bit there, Steph.
I didn't look at the incentive numbers, but if I would guess, it's partly incentive. And they did do a really brilliant marketing job with the whole Star Wars thing, and it touched a nerve, and I think that's part of it as well. And it could be a little bit more fleet. Honda's CR-V did quite well still, but Honda doesn't fleet, and Honda's, even with the CR-V being brand new, but their incentives are low on it.
Yeah.
And Rogue is just a touch older. And Nissan has tried to get ahead of Honda a couple of times, and they did again. They did in February. They haven't been able to maintain that lead as a whole. And when they have, it's generally been about incentives and fleet.
Okay, Jeff Taylor wrote in to say, I'd love to know the panel's opinion on the drop in Lexus sales. For my wife and I, the combination of the rolling abomination styling and drastic increase in maintenance costs means my wife's current Lexus will probably be our last one.
So how does he really feel about Lexus?
Yes.
And I'm guessing he's talking about the spindle grill. I mean, that is just such
a
dividing. It's so polarizing.
It is.
I'm personally not a fan of it. But I, the people who like it say it stands out on the road. And yes, it does stand out on the road. I guess I will exceed that point. But
there's the spindle grill up there.
Yeah. I don't quite get it.
All right. Yeah. So isn't this a case that Toyota and Lexus have long had the problem of being described as appliances, soulless appliances, no style, blah, 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 right?
Yep.
And so these guys have basically said, you know what?
We're going to punch up.
You want
take into it you want, to 11.
You want, we're going to turn it up to 11. And they've basically done that, right?
Yep.
Now, I mean, if they didn't do that, we'd be bitching about they just look too bland.
Yep.
And now that they've amped it up, it's just like, oh, it's too
they're
crazy.
They're still learning what that design language is going to be and how to express it and how to communicate it. I keep thinking that, you know, maybe Toyota or Lexus, I mean, they've got chief styling heads, but maybe they would benefit from having somebody come in from a design perspective and help guide them to the directions they want to see. They know what they want to express. And they're learning how to do that. And maybe if they had somebody who kind of came in and told them what their design language should be, but helped them figure out how to really express it a little bit more strongly or a little bit more efficiently. A little bit better. I don't know.
Erase
better.
A few lines. I mean, but there's times when I feel like it's like an Etch-a-Sketch that went crazy when you just see all
little,
these lines leading into I don't know where.
It's a little messy and it's a little fussy, and I think they're still developing what they're really going to be. But the other thing with Lexus in particular is they had so much success being comfortable, being reliable, being dependable, making you feel a little bit luxurious, or at least you had the stuff that you wanted. And they've shifted a little bit, or they're trying to shift what their personality is. And that always risks changing your customer base. We were talking about Lincoln Continental doing so well. It out-Lexus the Lexus LS, the first one for sure. I mean, that's where that space is. And there's clearly buyers who still want that. So
okay,
is
Lexus doing what Cadillac is doing, which is basically addressing the European performance thing and leaving, as you said, that, you know, Lexus used to be known as being comfortable.
I don't think they want to go as far with it as Cadillac and as far as the Europeans, but they're definitely trying to inject that in there. And I kind of wondered why. I mean, you always want to evolve yourself and you want to grow as a brand and you want to develop, but to develop a whole other direction that isn't selling as well as your current formula.
They've got a mandate from the top. I mean, from Japan at the top, they've got a mandate to make these more fun to drive, more dynamic, and to look and act the part. So they're following through on orders.
Too much into one month's numbers.
But it was a bad month.
It was a bad month. There's no question. I agree. But I wouldn't throw out the strategy just yet.
No, I would advocate it needs some evolution and to be a little bit careful with it.
I think we just might get used to it. But in terms of his question regarding the increase in repair costs, I mean,
I haven't heard that.
Heard that, so I can't. So,
yeah, I can't either. It might be his vehicle. He's got a bit of a lemon. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, we got a couple of phone calls here. Carmen, let's bring in one.
Hi, John, Gary, and invited guests. This is Dale Leonard, Cleveland, Ohio. I just would like the panel's comments on the sad sales figures for Volvo. I just attended the Cleveland Auto Show, and I thought those were outstanding automobiles. Their design just knocks it out of the park. Thank you. Wonderful show. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dale. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up. So, Steph, why don't you start?
We've been talking about that earlier. You know, the XC90 is stunning, and so is the S90. I think the S90, it's a little bit early to decide if it's going to be successful or not, but it's in an executive luxury segment that it's a tough segment. And we've got Continental, we've got CT6, and it's just a really tough segment right now. It's not one that's growing, so it's going to be hard for them to get a foothold in that space, even as beautiful as it is. The XC90 is a little more concerning, actually. I kind of wonder,
I'd be pushing the panic button. I'd go to full red alert if I were Volvo.
Sure.
Sales cratered.
Is it possible that you kind of got who was interested in trying something new and different? Did you get like the big crush of people who was? And is there
future? Yeah, you did have all the early adopters. I think that there are a lot of people out there because it is beautiful, and I think that they're out there and they want to buy it, and then they're put off by the price. I think that they think that Volvo is more affordable than it is, and they get into the showroom and go, "Oh my, that's." That's a lot more than I thought it was going to be. And that's why I think we really want to watch the XC60, which will be unveiled in Geneva. Because, as I said earlier, it's old in the tooth and it's having its best sales ever because it's in a good segment. So it'll be the more affordable XC90.
That's a good point.
It'll be really interesting to see. So are all these people who've lusted for an XC90 and can't afford it, are they going to hop into the market when they see the new XC60, which will, of course, migrate to the same platform as the XC90, so it'll have all the same functionality. It'll have nice lines at that new architecture. Because it's still riding on the old EUCD platform from Ford.
Wow.
So that's, that's the old Ford platform. So, it's got some limitations.
Yeah, I think XC90 was down 45%. And I think the S90 is
XC90, 46%.
46%. And the S90 just dead in the water.
Just
dead. Now, that's true of a lot of passenger cars, but I think they only sold a couple of hundred.
Yeah, but S90, you know what exists.
Exactly.
You know, okay, but the weird awareness thing here is that total Volvo car is up 48.5%, but total Volvo light truck is down 28.6%. So the Volvo truck is not doing well.
Well, that's the XC90.
But for these monthly sales, I mean, we're looking at, you know,
a little snapshot.
We could park them in here.
Right.
We
right.
still have a room.
That's right.
We have to use the rest of the studio. I just want to make that clear, not just this studio.
Yeah.
Okay, we got another phone call. Let's bring that one in.
Hi, guys. Great show. Really enjoy it. My question today is about the Compass and why on earth they aren't offering the Trailhawk with a manual or option, at least. I've always felt that the Grand Cherokee, Trailhawk, and every Jeep should offer a four-wheel drive, low-tech, low-option manual version, and have always scratched my head at why they don't. Really look forward to your answer. I can only assume that it's got something to do with the bottom line, but it seems like for brand image and, that's equally important to the bottom line, they should offer that option of a low-budget, four-wheel drive version that the hardcore enthusiasts can appreciate. Anyway, thanks again, guys. Look forward to the answer.
Yeah, good question. Good comment.
It's a front drive car platform. I think trying to do a Wrangler-esque four-wheel drive on that platform might be difficult. It does. You guys obviously.
Yeah, it's got the capability of doing it. But
it does. But when it's got the off-road capability through the electronics.
Right.
Not through the core platform.
Yeah.
And I do think the take rate on the manual, while I prefer manuals generally, I think the take rate's not that high. So you just don't. It ends up not being worth it.
It's a great question. I believe the answer is you can only get the manual with the front-wheel drive
right.
version. I think in any of the automatics, you get a choice of a 6-speed or a 9-speed automatic. But that's only in the U.S. market. So I'll bet you in other markets you can get.
It's one of these 17 combinations.
Right.
That's a great point that Gary makes there.
But not necessarily with the Trailhawk level of off-road capability.
Very possibly. But I'm sure it is bottom line. I'm sure it's to what Stephanie's saying, not a very good take rate, not in the U.S. market, but I think they just wanted a loss leader. I think the base price is around $22,000,
yeah.
And I'm sure that's with the manual transmission.
Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, does the Wrangler, when it comes out the next time, does it have this low-tech solution that
it may.
He alludes to?
I'm not sure that it will. I mean, all the things that we're hearing, we might be surprised at this next Wrangler. It might not be sort of a nod to all of the past Wranglers.
I think it might
I'm hearing the opposite.
Yeah.
I talked to the head designer, and he says it's going to look just like the moment.
No, not look, but I'm just saying, do you think it'll still have...
So in other words, there'll be electronics.
It might evolve. The electronics
might rather than having
I think they will, but I think you'll still have that a more basic system. I think the Grand Cherokee has four systems on it, and I think that you'll still see a much wider variety and range for off-wheel for
well, especially being
right,
a global
sport,
vehicle.
Your
levels
have to, are all electronically based, though, so that they work through the transfer cases. Versus what he was talking about is just basically hardcore manual transmission that you crawl over the rocks with.
Yeah,
so
and I don't know
the Wrangler would
be in the
place to do that if
so,
they can.
So she
do
says
it.
No, you say yes.
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying that I.
You think no. Come on.
I'll bet you the Wrangler is the quintessential Jeep. It is the off-road vehicle. I'll bet it comes with a manual, even with all-wheel drive.
One of the things
that company
has been really, really strong at is keeping the Jeep image alive and to be able to deliver on what it sees as the core values and the core dynamics of that. And a really robust and to some degree low-tech 4x4 system for the Wrangler, I think, is going to be maybe part of that. You'll still have the electronics moving it along, and you'll have the higher-end versions that have more electronics. But I would not be surprised to see a pretty basic, low kind of entry-level kind of just get-in-the-dirt system still being offered.
So they can't lose any capability. I mean, they can't lose even an inch of ground.
So you think maybe the Bronco has caused these guys are going to have to... elevate their game a little bit here with the Wrangler?
I don't think so.
Bronco's going to be chasing Wrangler, not the other way around.
Yeah. I think they just swatted away like a fly.
I'm cutting y'all off because we got to take another quick break. There are some people here that keep the show going with their sponsorship, and we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location,
driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. Gary, I know you had some more topics, but I just wanted to give a couple of comments from the people out in the audience there. Our work says the reason mass transit is going down is terrorism news. Also in D.C., it's because of accidents and safe tracks. So I don't know if that's really the case. I think it's got more to do.
It's not the case in Detroit.
It's not the case.
Well,
right.
Mass transit isn't the case in Detroit.
So. That's right. But anyway, so what else, Gary, did you want to get into?
Well, there was the always controversial Consumer Reports came out with their ratings of cars, naming their best cars. So let's quickly go through these, and I want your response, okay, all of you, to respond to these, if you've driven them or not, okay? Best subcompact, Toyota IA, which used to be a Scion.
Mm-hmm.
Any impressions?
Nope.
All right.
They can't give that thing away, right? What are the sales on that?
They actually weren't bad.
Really?
Yeah, I was surprised to see that. All right, next one. Compact, Chevy Cruze.
I like the Cruze. Yeah.
I like the Cruze a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's nice to see that one pick up a bit.
Okay.
It fell in the rankings against its competitors, but it still had a good month compared to its prior months. So
compact hybrid Prius. Your bete noire, the car that you don't understand.
I don't like the car. Fantastic fuel economy, brilliant from that standpoint.
I thought you liked the new suspension.
No.
Yeah.
The new one.
Well,
better.
It's sort of better.
I don't like the look of the new one.
Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah, there's the Etch-a-Sketch gone crazy there.
Yeah, it's not even a Lexus. Sports car, MX-5.
Oh, yeah. How do
you
not like that?
So how do you not like the Miata? Is that what you're saying?
Still on a retractable hardtop. I'm just going to.
Yeah, I love.
Well, you can get one.
The MX-5.
No, you can't. The RF is a Targa. That's not a retractable hardtop.
Midsize sedan, Kia Optima.
Optima's nice car, actually.
Yeah,
I'm all right with that.
The perfect sedan 10 years too late.
Yeah.
Because nobody's buying sedans.
Because nobody's buying sedans.
Right. Okay. Nothing wrong. It's not like
wrong
old
with
tech.
No, I said it's just perfect car.
No.
Right.
Just
okay. 10 years ago.
Large sedan, Chevy Impala. Chevy's doing all right here. We got the Cruze and Impala.
Yeah, the Impala's
a solid car.
Really nice.
It's not selling very well, but I know some people that own them. They love them. Love them.
It drives really nicely. Lots of room.
Yep. Yeah.
And it is a second.
Boy, not selling very well struggling. It's an understatement. It's down 1.2% for the year.
Yeah.
I think it has an image problem. People think of it the old Impalas.
I think the segment.
It's really expensive, though.
How nice it is.
It's the segment.
It's the segment.
The whole segment.
I think it's the segment. It's if when you look at segments that I don't think that cars are going away forever. I don't think sedans are going away forever. But we may see that large sedan formula slip off. Functionally, why do you need an Impala over a Malibu? Mm-hmm. The size is close enough that you. There's little you can do in the Impala.
It's sort of not one of those aspirational vehicles.
The Malibu is down 42%, so more people are looking at that Impala. Small SUV, the Forester.
It's a Subaru.
Yeah, I mean,
Subaru can do no wrong.
Exactly right.
From a sales,
but it's
not a great vehicle.
But it's a super loyal base again, and you have to remember these come from people giving feedback about their cars.
Right.
So you're going to have a Prius and a Subaru are always going to have a really loyal.
Well, but you're going to. But if you're saying compact hybrid, what choices do they have, basically, right?
Yeah, not many.
Yeah, the C-Max.
All right.
There might be one out there.
Yeah. Midsize SUV, Toyota Highlander. Man, you got snooze in here. All right, luxury SUV, Audi Q7.
Yay.
Yeah.
Got to get a yay in there somewhere.
All right. The last one, and now I know you guys have to say something about this one. The compact pickup Ridgeline, Honda Ridgeline.
It's reliability. I think is where they came in on that. I mean, because the
new Ridgeline is a nice car. We did a whole show about the damn thing.
Yeah. So is the Colorado. I mean, you fall into a Colorado camp or you fall into a Ridgeline camp.
Right.
And Consumer Reports editors, and they're basing this on their test reviews and feedback from their viewers or their readers.
Their readers.
Right? they're not real truck people. And this is the truck for people who are not real truck people. So, of course, they love it.
Yeah, they love
it. All right. So they also did a brand report card. We won't go through all of them, but the
because our responses are not good enough.
No. There's a whole list of them, but I just want to take the top one and the bottom one. The top one is Audi. Audi scores 81.
Again.
Top brand owned in Consumer Reports. The bottom one is Fiat at 41.
Yeah. Neither one is a surprise.
It's not a surprise. Why is it not a surprise?
Because FCA always comes on the bottom on quality.
Yeah. But Audi is a surprise. Audi rarely scores up at the top like that in the J.D. Power and all the other surveys that are out there.
Yeah, well, it's usually always either Porsche or Audi.
Well, Audi, like I said, Porsche, yes, but not so much Audi. Audi has had, in fact, a reliability issue in years past.
Lexus used to be able to be up there, but
It's Audi, Porsche, BMW, Lexus. So there you go. I mean, let's be fair.
And again, the numbers are probably very small
between
them. I only
gave the top one.
And remember, this isn't just how good the quality is. No. This is based on their test drives.
Right.
And luxury cars should do better. I mean, you spend more money on it, you better have a better car.
Mm-hmm. But to the point of, you know, their readers versus others. So last week we didn't talk about this, but the J.D. Power Vehicle Dependability Study came out. So that's 3 years of ownership.
Right.
Lexus came out on top. Porsche, Toyota, Buick, and then Audi is way down at just two places above industry average. So that seems a little odd, right? I mean, they're number
one.
I'm
going to guess that was a lot of electronic issues and glitches.
Yeah, but it's electronic issues for everybody. Everybody has the same thing.
But you're not comparing.
They would have more than the Chevy.
Studies.
Well, Audi would have more than the Chevy, but it wouldn't have more than Lexus.
Correct.
No, I know.
But so I'm just saying
people probably found problems.
No, well, what you're looking at here, the brand health report takes a sum of four different metrics that Consumer Reports use, and that's dependability over 3 years. It would be more accurate to compare that against Consumer Reports' initial or their quality surveys. They have a reliability. The Consumer Reports reliability brand report would be more accurate to compare against the J.D. Power quality report.
Yeah.
All right. On a lighter subject, we got another question.
No, go right ahead, Gary.
This is a thing that I found. This is just there's a software company in Ottawa, Canada. So I'm trying to reach out across the border there. And so it is a Canada-based engineering, design, and technology company focused on the emerging connected car market. And they did a survey of 3,116 consumers. And it is, now they have the question, would you ever ride in a self-driving car? Okay. So these numbers are sort of interesting. Yes, 38.2%. No, 24.8%. I don't know, 37.1%. So I don't know and yes, almost tie.
Yeah.
So seems somewhat legitimate, don't you think?
Very trusting Canadians.
Well, I don't know that. It was a Canadian company. I'm sure that these three wouldn't. But this is the thing that I found to be the most bizarre thing I've seen on a survey in a long time. Which of the below activities are you regularly tempted to do while driving? 43. Yes, you laugh.
Yeah.
That is on there, Stephanie.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
We'll get there.
In other words,
what
do you do?
No. So, I like this. Eat / prepare food, 43%. That was number one on the list.
So they're chopping onions on the way to work.
I mean, it's just like,
okay, good.
You don't get to pour the milk in this.
So, I mean, there is make phone calls, 2/10 of a percent away. But so your insidious laugh there. So which of the below activities are you regularly tempted to do while driving? Have sex, 4.7%.
No, not while driving.
I mean, and this 4. Is above.
7?
This is 4.7, which is above pass on the shoulder or drive illegally, play mobile games, change clothes, live stream my driving. Have you heard of this?
Yeah. Isn't that Russia?
Anyway.
Just GoPro it.
That was a rather funny little study that was done.
Interesting.
Prepare food.
Okay, we've got some more questions here from viewers. If I can say this right, Kaizen Tengu, and I butchered it, but you know who you are, wants to know, do you think a major truck company will reintroduce a pickup with four-wheel steering?
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
It'd be terrific.
I think that would be terrific. I think they're a little afraid. GM certainly got...
Well, GM tried it.
They
was it GMC?
No, it was Chevy and GMC, right. But it was just, yeah. it was way overpriced, and the truck owners in that space already felt they knew how to drive their trucks. So they weren't really interested in spending $4,000 on something that made them a better truck driver, because they've been driving trucks for 30 years. They know how to do this. Now, I don't drive a truck every day. I thought it was pretty awesome.
I thought it was really awesome. And last summer, I drove a development mule that ZF has that they had on a Ford F-150, or maybe it was a 250. I can't remember. But they've done it in a way that they think they're taking a lot of cost out. So if somebody comes along with that.
If you can get the cost into a good space, then sure. Because I don't think that it was an issue of owners and of potential buyers not liking the system.
Yeah, or a problem with the technology.
No. It was just the cost was too high to get somebody to check the box for something they felt they knew how to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe they didn't understand what the benefit of it was.
That could be. And the difference between then and now, too, is we have generally a lot more adaptive drive systems. We have a ton more electronics in the car. And so we're a little bit more familiar and accustomed to letting the car help us do things than we were 15 years ago when that came out.
I think we're losing our feel for driving.
Like 20.
You know?
Not you.
Yeah. Well, 18 maybe. Michael Ma from San Francisco writes in to say he heard us talking about Cadillac. He says the reason they're down is that no one wants the ATS and CTS. It's taken them too long to get a CUV into production. And he says... the public doesn't seem to like the Dare Greatly marketing approach.
Well, I mean, Cadillac, first off, Johan would be the first to agree with him that they couldn't get the CUVs into the product line fast enough. Yeah. So, you know, they're very aware of that problem.
It's a bit of a hangover from the recession, really. And this is the brand that's kind of feeling it, the last lingering effects, I think, because GM had to decide what they were going to do with their money at that point. And at that point, they just couldn't give it to Cadillac.
Yeah. And as for the campaign,
I think
I'm not a huge fan of it either, but I don't know. I haven't really seen any studies saying whether it's really giving them a bump or not a bump.
Yeah, I haven't seen either. I think more important for whether it's Dare Greatly or some other form, Cadillac needs some consistent advertising. And even if not everybody likes Dare Greatly, some people like it, some people don't, stick with it for a while longer and have a consistent message. Mm-hmm. It's not a bad message to have.
No.
It's much more important to be consistent. The first 4 or 5 months
don't confuse the consumer any right. further.
Yeah. Don't confuse consumer any further.
But to his point, though, I mean, saying that, you know, nobody really wants to buy the ATS or the CTS, that's a real problem. I mean, because last year they sold 21,000 the year before, and this is ATS 21,000 versus 26,000 the year before, CTS 15,000 versus 19,000 in both
I mean, in February, only 37% of all sales were cars.
But this is the last year for the year.
Oh, but this trend has been going on for a couple of years now. I mean, even last year at this time, it was only something like 42% of all vehicle sales were cars. Mm-hmm. So they are part of the, it's not unique to Cadillac.
I think
those vehicles have not taken off, and it doesn't help that they're in a segment that is on decline. So you put those two things together. And they refuse to give incentives. So that's the other thing, too. They're holding the line on price.
They've reduced the incentives. They're not.
Which is smart.
You're not pushing them out the door by putting the money.
And so they've changed the production capacity at the plant, taking a shift out instead of kicking them out and doing more incentives.
Yeah. Right.
So they're trying to balance that. Then to Elisa's point, they know where their product weaknesses are in terms of the product range. And they're going to get there as fast as they can.
It's going to be fast enough.
Why wouldn't it? I mean, so you're going to have a difficult couple of years. It's a 100-year-old brand, 110-year-old brand. It's not going to disappear because it doesn't have a small CUV in 2018 and it comes in 2019 or 2020 instead. It'll be difficult for them in that meantime, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the brand can survive that.
Yeah. Okay, we got one more question to get from one of our viewers, who Royal with Cheese asks, and I'm not sure I fully understand this question, but we'll talk about it anyway. He says, do you think that Tesla is opening the U.S. market to China intentionally to hurt bigger automakers?
Don't know how Tesla's opening the U.S. market to China?
Yeah, I think maybe what he's getting at is that Tesla's exporting cars to China now. And, in fact, I saw something. I haven't been able to read up on it. I think they tripled their sales in China in the last month or two.
I didn't catch their China numbers, but they were really low before. And
say,
it's
that, yeah. Not, not the, like it's coming from a big number to start with.
Right. And
other people export.
Other people are
China,
exporting in China
so
and have
in far bigger numbers than
far
Tesla.
Far bigger numbers than Tesla.
Is that, I mean, wouldn't the bigger issue be, say, for example, Buick importing cars from China? I mean.
Yeah.
Would be a more interesting question.
Or
maybe he's referring to the Tesla-inspired Faraday Future and Lucid Motors that are Chinese-backed companies that are trying to make a go of it with a similar model here because it's attractive. But and it doesn't make money.
Yeah.
But they're going to go for it. That may be where his question is coming from, and that's an interesting one because it's certainly what Tesla has done is convinced people that you don't actually have to know how to make cars in order to make cars. Tesla's learning that you do have to know how to make cars in order to make cars, and they're working very hard to make sure that they bring their manufacturing to where it needs to be. But certainly, Tesla being able to come in and disrupt things and make some noise, if not money, has changed some of the conversation and has encouraged some people to try that may or may not have tried before.
Because it is a lot easier. If you're going to come into the market, it's a lot easier to come in and make an electric vehicle because a motor is a lot easier to make than an engine. So if you're going to come in and do a one-off or small volume, whatever, go electric. Yeah. A lot easier.
That it is. Well, hey, look, we've burned up about an hour here. We should wrap it up, but Stephanie Brindley from IHS Market and Alisa Priddle from Motor Trend, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
that's great.
It's great. Very controversial. We got to do this more often.
We do. No, this is really good. So
we never even got to the Geneva show next.
I know.
Right?
That's
we'll
exactly
have to come
right.
back and talk about it after the show.
Right.
So Gary, let's do another show next week.
Okie doke.
Okay. I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
Well, that was fun.
Very good.
You didn't think it was fun?
Yeah.
Just checking.
Absolutely.
So did you had notes for Geneva?
Yes.
Anything super coming there that you see?
Just the ones that I thought were going to be interesting. I mean, obviously, there's the Civic Type R. The RS Q8 concept, so the performance version of it. The Volvo XC60, which is a...
Didn't they show the Type R in L.A.?
Concept.
Oh,
they didn't show the production
one. There'll be the LS hybrid.
The concept.
It's so close.
It's so close.
They didn't tell
but
us all the
Porsche Panamera wagon looks gorgeous.
That's what
I probably won't come here, but boy, it looks nice.
While you still have your mics on, the guy with the Tesla question just wrote in his question.
Oh, okay.
So we can get it right.
So are we doing like a encore?
I still don't get it. Do you think that Tesla is opening the U.S. market? Is this the... Hold on, let me refresh. Maybe I... No, I meant the selling direct to the public, getting around the franchise laws.
What's that to do with China? That's how they do it here.
No, I think maybe we talked about last week,
Link
and company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is owned by...
Now we get
which
it right.
Which is basically saying, okay, we don't want to sell cars through dealerships as well, but we want to have a subscription model, which I think is different than the direct sales model that Tesla has. And so what they're basically saying is that you come to us and you get it like a cell phone. So you have this vehicle for a couple of years the same way, and then you come in and you trade it or you upgrade it or, you know.
Or like Cadillac's doing a new leasing program.
Right, except so what Lincoln Company is basically saying is that our vehicles won't have a price per se. Okay.
Right, and right. You pay for the subscription.
So you pay for the subscription, and Cadillac, yes, is doing the same thing with the book
right.
program,
right.
which is like, what does it cost like?
It's $1,500 a month, and if you really think about the platinum version of the Escalade, and because it's initially all platinum versions,
mm-hmm.
so and you add in the fact that you're not paying insurance and a couple of other things, it's not cheap, but it's not that far off from $100,000 you know, Escalade Platinum lease plus insurance.
Right.
So it's more money than I can afford, but it's not really necessarily stupid money for what they're looking at.
And aren't they just doing this in Manhattan?
And it's just Manhattan. They're just testing it and trying to place it.
You know, the people there got the money.
People want to do it.
They want to do it. So
it's definitely a 1% sort of situation. But what Tesla has done is got people to think about things a little bit differently. I don't think that Lynx & Co.'s situation or idea is specific to China. So, no, I don't think Tesla necessarily opened it up to China, but it did open up and is pushing the auto industry to think about things a little bit differently. And you also have millennials and consumers wanting to shop differently.
Yeah, I would just say it's Amazon more than Tesla or anybody else.
Yeah.
It's like we've just suddenly become used to doing things entirely differently. Why shouldn't cars be the same way?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think Royal brings up a good point. You know, Tesla's doing an end run around the franchise system. Lincoln Company wants to do the same thing. They don't want a franchise agreement. They want to work with dealers, but they don't want a franchise network.
Well, and Tesla doesn't even want to work with dealers.
Right.
I think
at all. Exactly. And, you know, you can do that if you're going to be a niche player.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be, I don't know how.
With the Model 3, I don't know how you do it. I mean, you've got a service.
Right. That's going to be not just service.
Well, they have service, though.
What about
but service can be tough with your Model S's right now, and there's so few of them that you can get your way around. Like when we were at the Chicago Auto Show, our Uber one night was a Tesla Model S, and we're talking to the guy like, you know, oh, I love it. Do you have any trouble with it? She said, well, it breaks down at least once a month, and I have to send it away for 2 to 3 days each time because there's not anybody nearby. You go, but I love my car. I mean, you're not going to be able to do that if you have 200,000 Model 3s out there.
Right.
Just have all these cars go off for 3 days at a time and look after these.
And when you go to that individual
manner. Let's say that Elon got really smart and said, you know what, I'm going to make a deal with Penske Auto Centers. And you know, we're going to have Penske Auto Centers will become certified master Tesla fixers, right? And, you know, you've got this thing, you've got a network across the country, it's all built in, it's all done. You know, that seems to me to be a trivial problem that these guys can address.
It's an addressable problem, but it isn't one that they've...
But they don't seem to want to.
...about doing that. They've talked about investing in their service centers, and part of their quarterly quarterly earnings statement in their letter to shareholders last month, or this month, did talk about how they've reduced, like, some percentage get their car back in one day now, and that percentage is much higher than it used to
be.
So they're still trying to address it on their own. And
the other thing, too, is the model in this country is, I got a car, I want to buy a new one, I take my old one in, I get a trade-in. Well, you don't do trade-ins with Tesla. There's no dealer to do the trade-in.
Right.
They tell you, go sell it on CarMax. Now what happens, to your point, Elisa, when you ramp that up? And in fact, he's not talking 200,000. In a few years, he's talking 500,000.
Yeah, exactly. He's talking half a mil. Like,
and
just,
now I bring my used one back, you know, and I want a new one. Or I see this breaking down as they scale up.
Yeah, and as these older cars, these off-lease ones, are they going to be as attentive to these owners? I don't know.
I don't know either, right?
Good question.
Well, we'll do the show in 3 years, and we'll have better answers.
Well,
maybe this whole secondary gray market that'll be dealing with these things.
Yeah, the Teslas. Yeah. But it's certainly interesting that people are thinking about it a little bit differently. And automakers, traditional automakers, are thinking about how to do these things and where can they change and what sort of models will work. And sort of the disruptors won't necessarily own that.
Well, the real question is selling direct cheaper? Do you save money? Because the whole idea is, hey, wipe out the middleman, i.e. the dealer, But when you look at dealers, they barely make any money on new cars.
Yeah, it's all on the, it's on
right.
the service.
It's all in the service, right? Yeah. The finance and all that.
I would think that, I mean, really, you know, if the automakers could be profitable owning their own dealerships, they'd have owned their own dealerships, and they have tried at different points to get in that. And largely, they've discovered that the skill set and that the company needs to build a car is fundamentally different than it needs to sell it on the ground. Supporting your dealers is one thing, but being able to sell it to, you know, anybody who just walks in is a much different skill set, and it's much more, and it's you've got it, then you'd have a capital intensive environment with the manufacturing and everything that you need to go in there, and then you've also got real estate heavy, so you've got huge investment on both sides of it and low margins on both sides of it, and it doesn't really work that well to try and own all of it.
Yeah, you know, in Europe, their franchise laws are different than here, and the factories can have, they're capped, but they can have factory stores. Yeah. And I want to say, going back 3 years ago, Dieter Zetsche was under enormous pressure, under enormous pressure from the investment community to get rid of all those company stores because they all lost money.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember they, FCA tried to open one in L.A., a company store? Mm-hmm. I don't know if... I think it all fell apart. It was a crazy deal.
There's crazy deals. So, for example, in Manhattan, there's a number of car dealerships. They're called factory stores because they get enormous support from the factory, because otherwise...
They build showrooms that are gorgeous.
They build these million-dollar showrooms. They can't make any money. So I don't know what the actual, you know, franchise agreement is, but they're not as independent. But without that factory support, so Cadillac believes, Audi believes, Mercedes, but they have to have stores in Manhattan. Yeah. But it's a little bit different, and I wish I knew the details.
More galleries than they are stores. I know the Cadillac showroom in Manhattan isn't really, it's a gallery situation. Mm-hmm. They've got three cars on display. You can find out more about the car, but I don't think you can actually purchase directly from that location.
Mm-hmm. Which then leads you to the Ford, like the little, you know, the pop-up, you know, in malls, how you're going to have little Ford things. I forget what the, you know, part of that. What is it called? Ford Pass.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to have those, you know, you'll go into a mall and there'll be like a Ford store and you can learn about cars and life.
Learn how to work sync.
Right. Yeah.
Well, good.